The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, good morning. How are you?
Boker tov, mo'adim l'simcha. Just some snippets before we get onto the main stuff that we're going to talk about. President Rivlin is due to receive the official election results this morning at 11 o'clock from the Central Election Committee. It's a kind of a formal ceremony. They have now formally decided that the election was free and fair and that no fraud was detected in a way that would influence the results in any way. So we can call that final now. But we know that even though he will receive those results this morning at 11 o'clock, nothing really is going to be done until next week. Although behind the scenes, there's still a lot of maneuvering going on. And the most recent and the most interesting is where Gideon Saar from the New Hope Party, the Tikva Chadasha, he, of course, is a breakaway faction from the Likud. He is apparently trying to convince Yair Lapid to allow Naftali Bennett to be prime minister in the anti-Netanyahu camp. And that is in order to try to somehow get from the president next week the mandate in order to form the government. Because I think that what Gideon Saar fears is that there will be a split in the change camp. Some people supporting Bennett, some people supporting Yair Lapid. And by that, he might well hand the mandate over to Netanyahu. And as we heard in our chat yesterday, the president is minded only to allow one party to form the government and if they fail to go back to elections. So, of course, the change camp is very, very eager to get that mandate for themselves. I think it's an interesting concept that Yair Lapid with 17 seats allows Naftali Bennett with many less seats to stand in front and get the prime ministerial vote. I suspect there might be a rotation if indeed they do manage to form a government, but it's an interesting way of looking at things. And just to related stories that S&P, Standard & Poor's have come out with their latest rating for Israel. And it's interesting that they've kept it at AA- stable, unchanged from the previous rating. The comment is that they are concerned about the inconclusive election results and they have warned on potential political instability, but then goes on to say that they do not expect any changes in economic factors supporting the current economic rating. So what they're saying is that even though there is concern about the political instability, economically things are strong enough to almost overcome that political instability to allow them to rate it at AA- unchanged.
It's so interesting because I hardly even see it as politically unstable. I think it's too stable. There hasn't been a change in Israel's political sort of landscape for years and years and years, which is quite ironic because, you know, Israel keeps going back to the polls but coming out with pretty much the same thing.
I suppose that's a different way of looking at things. No government, very stable.
Yeah, exactly. All right. There's been speculation that Turkey requested of Israel to return to full ambassadorial ties. Is there a thaw in the relationship with Turkey? Is the Turkey thawing?
I'm not sure that it really is, but as always in international diplomacy, it's all about the interests of various countries rather than about whether they have the heart to want to be friendly and whether this just seems the right thing. It's all about economic interests. It's all about political interests. And there are a few very, very fascinating things playing out in the background here. First of all, there was a report that suggested that Turkey had approached Israel to exchange ambassadors, which ambassadors haven't been in situation since that Mavi Marmara incident when Turkey recalled its ambassador, and we haven't really returned back to any semblance of usual business between Israel and Turkey. Lots and lots of issues have arisen. Turkey was falling very strongly into the Iranian camp. Turkey was being sidelined by a lot of the European powers and so forth, therefore looking for friends elsewhere. Iran was the obvious solution. But since then, we've read that Iran and China are becoming very friendly with each other with this agreement, this new deal that has been signed between Iran and China. I suspect that that may well have made Turkey feel a little isolated from the Iranian connection. In addition to that, There is a lot going on in the Mediterranean basin with regard to oil and gas extraction, and also with regard to various pipelines that are being built between Israel and Europe, mainland Europe, and a lot of cooperation between Israel and Cyprus. Of course, Cyprus is Turkey's arch rival. They still have that disagreement going on since the 1970s over northern Cyprus, where Turkey continues to be in occupation of the northern part of Cyprus. So therefore, that also brings Turkey into conflict with Greece. And now Turkey is looking for friends, looking for opportunities, looking for ways to get involved. Turkey remains at the crossroads between East and West. There can be little doubt that the days of Constantinople, where Constantinople was, that was, of course, the former name for the city of Istanbul, and that was the crossroads between East and West, and the Turkish traders really took major advantage of that location, that position. Turkey remains in a very, very strategic position. On the one hand, trying to get support, the United States trying to use Turkey to support its endeavors against Russia to locate certain anti-missile systems there. Turkey also being the crossroad between Russia and Europe for gas pipelines, Turkey being the crossroads between the Arab countries and the Western countries for various things. So I think that Turkey is starting to feel a little isolated, wants to get more involved in what's going on in the gas and oil exploration. There has been talk that the Prime Minister's office has been in touch with Turkey over the last few days about the whole issue of gas exploration within the Mediterranean basin. So I think that this is really all about interests coming together, Turkish interests really coming to the fore. They might well feel a little isolated from Iran and from potentially other friendships right now. So I think it's really all about trying to exercise their interests wherever they can. The Prime Minister's office has actually denied that Turkey has approached to exchange ambassadors, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if there are some discussions going on in the background with Turkey somehow trying to creep back into favor in order to exercise some of these economic interests. We know that Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is a very wily character, a very, very shrewd player on the international stage, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if on one day he criticizes Israel and on the next day he tries somehow to create relations with Israel, because that's what's in Turkey's interest right now.
Does it really matter? And does it, doesn't every country really, in essence, connect with another country because of mutual interest?
Oh, absolutely. I think that that's the way that things are done these days. But, you know, sometimes those mutual interests go very, very deep to a point that really might not be visible to the naked eye, to the bystander. I mean, for example, Turkey's relationship with the Arab world is very important. Arabs have traditionally been a big tourist market for Turkey, because especially in the wake of the 9/11 catastrophe and the way in which the Arab world was treated in the period that followed that, a lot of Arabs just felt much more comfortable taking their holidays in Turkey rather than going to the United States or to Europe, because of the suspicions and because of the difficulties that they found in traveling around. So Turkey became a massive destination for the Arab world, and we saw a lot of very, very large sums of Arab money flowing into Turkey. So Turkey was therefore very, very cautious to try to build those relations in order to encourage the tourism, bearing in mind, of course, that most Turks are also Muslims, so they have something in common, even though they're not Arabs themselves. But the Turkish tourism market goes in different directions. A lot of Russians have their holidays there. A lot of Israelis used to have holidays in Turkey. So Turkey was very, very eager to continue to have that tourist dollar coming into the country, and very, very cautious to try and build relations with the various countries where the tourists would come from. It's still, you know, the Turkey now seems to be going into lockdown, but up until now, they've been very open for tourism in order to try and encourage you know, whoever is willing to travel right now to come to Turkey. But also they need to look beyond just pure tourism to the natural gas that's going on that's being explored within the Mediterranean basin, and to exploit their position as this crossroads between East and West, between Russia and the Ukraine and the Western part of Europe, between the Arab world and the Western part of Europe. They do have a key location, and it's not always easy to understand what they're trying to exploit at any moment in time. I think they have different interests that they try to exploit at different moments in time, depending on the circumstances. So at the moment, it seems that Israel is on their agenda, from what we can gather behind the scenes.
Yeah, interesting. Before we chat about Bahrain, I just wanted to ask you about the Israel's COVID-19 variant. What is known about this?
It always has fascinated me how we identify these variants and then how we attribute them. And you know, Howard, we've had this discussion about, is it right to attribute a variant to a particular country and draw some dispersions on that country, the South African variant and the Brazilian variant and the UK variant. And I heard a rumor that they were wanting to name these variants like their name, hurricanes, you know, by ladies or men's names. So I just wonder, is it going to be like the Cyril variant and the Boris variant and the Bibi variant? I'm not quite sure how they're going to name them exactly. But apparently there is an Israeli variant, and apparently, according to what I've read, more than almost 200 people that they know of have been infected by this variant, especially from the north, from the Haifa area, and from the Beersheba area in the south. And we understand that this variant has been defined by a change in four amino acids in a location of the spike protein called 681. So this is how this particular variant has been identified, and it has not anywhere else in the world, and therefore it is labeled the Bibi variant or the Israeli variant. The good news about this variant is that it is not able to challenge vaccines. In other words, the vaccines are effective against this variant. But it seems as if though this is going to be the future for us in the COVID world, where these new variants and potentially mutations are going to pop up all the time. And each time we're going to have to check whether the vaccines that we're using are effective against it. But at least for now, the good news about the Israeli variant is that it is not immune to the vaccine. And we hope that it'll stay like that at least for the foreseeable future.
And finally, tell us about Bahrain appointing its first ever ambassador to Israel.
Yeah, so this is really exciting. I mean, obviously, this follows on the signing of the Abraham Accords towards the end of last year. Finally, this week, the Bahraini government advised with Foreign Minister Gabi Ashkenazi, who approved the appointment of the new ambassador to Israel from Bahrain. Interesting that it is quite a senior individual, somebody who has acted in an ambassadorial capacity for Bahrain in the United States as well. So I think it's considered to be a relatively senior member of the Bahraini diplomatic corps, someone who's also acted within Bahrain in the foreign ministry as a senior individual. He's the director of operations at the moment at the Bahraini foreign ministry, and was deputy chief of mission at the embassy in the United States up until 2013. We expect a team from Bahrain to arrive in Israel this week, or at least in the coming weeks, to set up an embassy. The embassy will be in the Tel Aviv area, we're told. So they're not putting their necks out as far as to establish their ambassadorial presence in Jerusalem. I think that presently would probably be a step too far. But the announcement of the formal appointment of the Bahraini ambassador is just another very, very exciting and very positive step forward in the overall relationship that's building between Israel and the United Arab Emirates.
Absolutely phenomenal that we're seeing, I mean, who would have ever imagined that this would have been the case? It was just unimaginable.
It was unimaginable a year or two ago, as recently as a year or two ago. And I think for some people, it still kind of takes a little bit of getting used to the fact that Israel is now entering into formal ambassadorial relations with Arab countries. Is that the end of the Arab-Israel conflict? Can we finally put that to bed and say it's over? I'm not sure, but it's certainly a major step forward.
Mike says Israeli variant is called the election variant, and it comes every few months but brings little change.